You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, places, and pot of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Take the Alameda Street exit off the 10 freeway into industrial downtown Los Angeles, drive 6 blocks, make a couple of quick turns, and you'll be right in front of a white brick building with silver metal doors. You've arrived at THC Design. It's one of the most popular legal weed brands based in L.A. They grow hundreds of pounds of frosty, fragrant cannabis in warehouses behind this office building. Step inside, and you'll see a cannabis grow operation that uses LED lights and technology that recycles all the water that they use. Even the humidity in the air gets recycled and reused. Edward Fairchild was recently in charge of marketing at THC Design.
We actually use more water for our workers to use the restroom than we use to grow the cannabis. So we recycle as much of it as we possibly can. I mean, it cuts down on our bills, but also it's just more environmentally friendly. And, you know, that's always been a focus for us from the beginning.
THC Design is one of several local indoor cannabis growers trying to become, well, greener. Environmental damage is one of the main problems associated with indoor cultivation, which is how most companies grow cannabis in Southern California. And there's a lot of growing going on here. That's led some in the industry here in LA to try to take a cleaner and greener approach. But can indoor cultivation actually be eco-friendly? Reporter Mary Carrion picks up this sticky story from here.
Growing commercial cannabis outdoors requires a few specific things. Open land, ample water, and the right terroir. Southern California lacks most of these features, which is why it's become the epicenter of legal indoor cannabis cultivation. There are outdoor grows in Southern California, but they're all illegal operations and have caused a lot of problems, according to Hyun-hae Sa, who runs the LA County Office of Cannabis Management.
Water theft, trespassing, pesticide and waste runoff, and increased criminal activity. We're just trying to move in good faith with these communities who are very upset, understandably so, and build better trust with both the industry and the community members, and just really show progress and steps that we're taking towards promoting responsible businesses.
Now, growing cannabis in the city of L.A. is legal, but it's not yet in L.A. County. New county regulations are being finalized, but they will only allow for indoor and solid structure greenhouse cultivation. The problem is that makes this county's grow operations not so environmentally friendly in a couple of different ways. First, let's look at water, which is always one of the biggest concerns with cannabis cultivation. It takes something like twice as much water to grow cannabis as it does to grow, say, wine grapes. But water is actually where indoor cannabis operations can shine, if they recycle it. Here's Ryan Gentleman, the CEO and founder of THC Design.
For every 100 grams of water we put on a plant, we actually only use 33 additional grams of water from the well or from the city. So that is where we are able to provide the most efficiencies to the environment, is through our recirculation of water.
Besides recycling water here in downtown LA, Gentleman is in the process of building out a cultivation facility in the Coachella Valley. That facility is going to run fully on renewable energy and also reuse water the way many commercial agriculture facilities do.
Once water goes into the grow, it never leaves. It's literally on an infinite loop. It shows you where commercial ag truly, truly is doing everything they can, whether they care about the environment or not, which farmers do, you know, farmers do. But it's because they can't waste anything.
But water isn't even the biggest problem with indoor cultivation. Researchers at Colorado State University estimate that carbon emissions associated with growing 1 ounce of indoor flower is about the same as burning between 7 to 16 gallons of gasoline. Jason Quinn is one of those CSU researchers.
When you look to California or Southern California, right, we are talking about, 2 tons of CO2 equivalent per kilogram of dried flower. And so like that is literally tons of CO2 are being emitted. Now,
and when he says tons, he is not kidding. Los Angeles, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties are home to more than 3 million square feet of legal indoor grows. I did a little math and came up with at least 2 million pounds of cannabis coming out of these counties per year, which all adds up to billions of metric tons of greenhouse gases.
If you were to transition to an outdoor grow facility, based on our first order calculations, you can have almost an instantaneous 80% reduction in those greenhouse gases.
The good news? Even for indoor grows, there is a better way. Out in Desert Hot Springs, the brand Gold Flora harvests hundreds of pounds of flower every week. And they use sophisticated, energy-efficient environmental controls. They've got this chilled water HVAC system, and it took a big capital investment to install it inside their 35,000-square-foot facility. But now that it's up and running, facilities manager Adam Yudka says it's really cost-effective.
It's no different than getting a $10,000 rebate back to go into an electric car. So the big thing is to just weigh it out and look at the cost payback and how long the payback's going to be back for our investors. There's got to be a reward in it. So it's all risk reward.
It may pay off, but Gold Flora isn't starting a trend. The only way cannabis businesses can afford the high cost of implementing energy-efficient systems is with the help of investors. And due to the industry downturn in California, most investors are not infusing capital into the cannabis industry right now. So, unfortunately, most legal cannabis cultivators can't shoulder the upfront cost. There is one more way for growers to clean up their act, which is create less waste. Most of the growing materials used in hydroponic growing facilities are thrown away after every harvest. Massive indoor grows like Gold Flora can harvest every week. At Ball Family Farms, a boutique cultivator based in South LA, head of genetics Ashton Howarth emphasizes how much trash this is.
It just ends up as landfill waste. And every single time you have a harvest, it goes right into the landfills.
Which is why Ball Family Farms switched from growing hydroponically in 2017 to growing in living soil. No more of those growing materials to dispose of. And their dirt has been kept healthy with the help of writhing earthworms that have lived and reproduced in the soil for the past 6 years.
Switching over to a soil system, we're able to actually treat and reuse the soil. So we've lessened our waste considerably.
So what does all of this cost? The growers interviewed for this story gave me a range of between $150,000 to $6 million, depending on the size of the facility. But they also unanimously agree that it's worth the cost. Adam Yudka says the investment pays off in roughly 3 to 5 years' time.
It's actually an economical gain for us. It turns out to be an environmental friendly practice, but it's actually a financially, beneficial practice for us as well.
Indoor cannabis cultivation still has a ways to go before it's actually eco-friendly. But at least in Southern California, these innovators are willing to give it a try. For KCRW, I'm Mary Carrion.
Still to come on GLA, more change coming to the LA City Council, how a couple of districts are getting settled. Updates on CD6 and CD10.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now this evening with more of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Conspiracy, bribery, secret racist recordings. LA's city council has repeatedly been rocked by scandal in recent years, and all of that drama has triggered resignations and suspensions, left some districts without regular representation at all for months or even years. In Council District 6 in the San Fernando Valley, a recent special primary election has narrowed the larger field into a top two. In District 10 in South L.A., after Councilman Mark Ridley Thomas's conviction, the council made a decision earlier today about what will happen there. Dakota Smith reports for the L.A. Times and has been keeping up with these races, the council in general, and she's with us right now. Hi, Dakota.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with Council District 6 in the eastern San Fernando Valley. We're talking former council president Nuri Martinez represented that district. She was caught making those racist statements on a leaked audio recording last fall. She then resigned. What is going on there? We do have, it's not certified yet, but we do have a top two going now to the runoff.
Right. We know based on how many votes they have left to count that the two people going to the June runoff will be Marissa Alcaraz and Imelda Padilla, two women who are born and raised in the San Fernando Valley and are well known there. So it'll be an interesting matchup to have these two, you know, pretty well-known figures running against one another.
Well, aside of from where they're from, talk a little bit about what they're about. Like, are these two progressive candidates? Or I understand, like, for example, they are for perhaps increasing money for the police, right?
Yeah, if you looked at the makeup of the city council, there's definitely some council members that are calling to abolish the police, for instance. And that isn't what these two women are about. Both support adding officers and both support 4118, which is the rule that basically says if you want to ban homeless camps from certain areas like schools and parks, you can do that. So, of course, these are progressive Democrats, these two women, but they are not as left as some of the other members of the city council.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Hugo Soto Martinez and Eunices Hernandez, right? So, I mean, are we seeing that whoever gets this council seat is going to be at odds with fellow council members?
I don't think so necessarily. Remember, Marissa Alcaraz, for instance, works for Curran Price, who is a progressive Democrat. And Imelda Padilla is backed by Monica Rodriguez, Councilmember Monica Rodriguez, who also is progressive. So it's really just shades of being a progressive here. Both Marissa and Imelda support raising, you know, the wages for workers too. So they have a history of fighting and being a champion for workers.
Because I bring up the police and I bring up those other things as far as, you know, the progressive candidates versus the maybe not as progressive candidates. I mean, were the voters of Council District 6 even concerned about those things, or did they have other things that they were voting for?
No, the voters that I talked to were concerned about crime, and they wanted police, more police. Some of the voters here were very upset with Nuri Martinez when she cut the police department after the protests over George Floyd. They were disappointed in her. So I think that that's the reason why Marco Santana, who came in third, he was a little less supportive of some of the policies around homelessness, for instance, 4118, he said he would seek to repeal it. I think perhaps that's why he didn't do as well in this district. This district, more votes were won by Rick Caruso in the mayor's race in this district than Karen Bass. So I think voters are a little more conservative here.
You reported that a few of the candidates in the race had big financial backers, like unions or corporations. How did that factor, do you think, into who was able to stand out?
Well, three of the seven candidates, either they raised a lot of money or they benefited from outside money. And that really shaped how they could get their name out there. Obviously, this is an election where there's not a lot of attention. So if your name is on a mailer, it's going to help a lot. And so the three that I mentioned before, Marco Santana, Imelda Padilla, and Marissa Alcaraz, they all benefited from either being able to raise some money, a significant amount of money, or having unions or corporations backing them.
Let's talk about Martinez for just a moment before she stepped down. I mean, did that scandal really hurt the trust that constituents had for the people who represent that district?
I think that people were already distrustful of City Hall in some ways. I think that this district has struggled to see large numbers of voters turn out. It's a majority Latino district. And as some of my colleagues at the LA Times have covered, Latinos don't always turn out in large numbers to vote for a variety of reasons. So I think that this district, you know, wasn't as engaged perhaps as some other parts of the city. And when you throw in the scandal, there's definitely disappointment. That was what was expressed to me by voters. They were frustrated and disappointed by Martinez's comments. But again, I also talked to voters who liked Martinez and liked the work she was doing in the district.
Special city council elections, Dakota, tend to have very low turnout. Was that true this time? Are we seeing that? I know the vote is very slow in coming in and what we're seeing, right?
118,000 voters were sent mail-in ballots. That's the number of registered voters in this district. And as of last week, there was about 14,000 votes that had been counted. So it's really just a fraction of the district that is participating, which is just too bad. And you think that given the drama surrounding Nury Martinez's resignation and why Martinez, who of course was the former representative of this district, of why she resigned following the leaked audio of the scandalous tape. You would think that, you know, with all that attention, perhaps voters would be, you know, more engaged. They would be paying attention and they would be more interested in choosing who their next representative is.
The runoff again in June between those two candidates, Padilla and Alcaraz. In Council District 10, I want to go to Council District 10 now because there was some news that happened today at City Hall as well. Heather Hutt was reappointed to replace, at least until the next election takes place in 2024, to replace Mark Ridley Thomas, who was convicted of fraud charges, bribery charges, right?
Yeah, so she was reappointed. It was sort of a nail biter. You know, the public didn't know which way it was going to go. She is already running, or she has said she's going to run for the seat, for Mark Ridley Thomas's seat. And she was one of three people who had been put in that seat to take care of the district. And there was some concern about whether she should be put back in because he was convicted by the jury. So something had to be done with the seat, or if there should be a special election. And Councilwoman Monica Rodriguez wanted a special election. She worried that the city wasn't being transparent enough. And City Council President Paul Krikorian pushed for Hutt. And ultimately, Hutt got through 11-1. So she was able to return to her seat.
All right, Dakota Smith, who covers City Hall for the LA Times. Dakota, thanks for coming on and telling us about these two really important council districts. We appreciate it.
Great. It's definitely a unique time at the council.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis, designing a way for artists to live a little cheaper in Orange County. The effects of rising rents and home prices all across the Southland are something we talk about, of course, a lot here on GLA. In Laguna Beach, artists who once found affordable housing are now being pushed out by rising rents and home prices. And the city council is stepping in to try to figure out a fix. Gustavo Arellano is here to talk with us about this latest housing kerfuffle down in OC. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Let's be clear that when we talk about the issue of housing prices, it's usually how low and even middle income folks are having such a hard time. Why is Laguna specifically talking about artists?
Because artists and art is intertwined with the identity that Laguna Beach has crafted for itself over a century. Laguna Beach, beautiful town, a lot of canyons right there on the ocean, spectacular cliffs. But because of that, for over a century, it's drawn a lot of artists. And also, art is part of their economy. We're almost on the summer, which means that's where you're going to have the Sawdust Festival. You're going to have Art Affair. And of course, you're going to have the Pageant of the Masters, that famous, what do they call it? Live art, where people pose as famous paintings from over the centuries for like 50 seconds, and then they turn around. So if you don't have artists living in Laguna Beach, then can you really call yourself a city of the arts?
They call themselves an artist colony, so historically, that's what it's been, right? But Laguna is a different place today, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, the joke used to be that the billionaires gentrified the millionaires, and now even more money's coming in. But as recently as, geez, I want to say 25 years ago, you could still, as an artist, rent a cheap place at, say, a house or something, and make a living as an artist. Those days are long, long gone. Really, the only days when you have that old time feel is during the summer when all the artists come in to these established festivals or pop up. The rent on PCH there, it's not going to be cheap wherever you go. So it's interesting, though, that now the city council is finally thinking, oh, yeah, maybe we should try to do something to be able to make it affordable for the next generation of artists so we can continue, you know, so art can still be part of our day-to-day life.
What's the specific plan, then, that the city council is trying to come up with?
Well, right now, you just have two council members. They've formed a subcommittee, and they're going to study the issue. And then in a couple of months, they're going to go to the rest of the city council and present it. And the city council, by the way, they passed it unanimously. They know that it is important. And right now, I mean, when you're studying the issue, it could be all sorts of things. One thing the city's not going to do, though, they're probably not going to build housing, and then they're going to be the landlord. So I see something like, you know, tax breaks for developers who are going to build new structures and maybe say, you know, like in other cities, you'll have affordable housing just for low-income people. Here, it would specifically be affordable housing for artists. That's one of the issues that have been, or one of the proposals that's already being talked about.
I mean, one of the things that's so interesting about it is historically artists are the first group, right, that moves into a struggling area, a neighborhood. Then they're among the first to be kicked out of the area because they've, you know, helped make it seem really cool. And then the wealthier people come in and they kick the artists out. Is that what's going on in Laguna?
Yeah, gentrification. That's the story of gentrification. The interesting thing with the artists there, they've been there, geez, there was the plain art movement, which was a method of calling these beautiful coastal scenes of Orange County and the rest of Southern California. That dates back to over a century. So Laguna Beach has this in their marrow, in their DNA. They need to, at least in their minds, they need to be associated day-to-day with the arts, because if you eliminate it, at least in the Laguna Beach mind, what's going to happen? And it's interesting because Laguna Beach also, unlike the rest of the coastal cities of Orange County, it's historically been on politically liberal to progressive. And so this is something, and it's also historically an LGBTQ colony itself, one of the few places decades ago when being LGBTQ was not acceptable in society, that it was a safe haven. So this is very important to the politicians of Laguna Beach.
Didn't Santa Ana do something similar a few years back?
Oh, yeah. That was classic gentrification, though, because in this case, Santa Ana was and is still a working class Latino town. And the city said, yeah, we don't want these working class Latinos. Let's bring in artists. And first it was mostly white artists. Now it's multicultural. And look, Santa Ana has a very vibrant art scene. But what Santa Ana's proposal was to build these live-work lofts that are in downtown. My wife has a store in downtown, so I'm walking around. They're nice people, but very few of them are artists. So the art scene in Santa Ana, it's only being kept up by people like Alicia Rojas and other muralists, but it's nowhere near what the city of Santa Ana tried to do 20 years ago.
And for what it's worth, in Laguna, the mayor there, Sue Kemp, said she doesn't want this bill to be footed by taxpayers.
Hey, it's still Orange County, so you're always going to have, you know, government's evil, but let's do a public-private partnership. But of course, now you have all sorts of different ways to be able to own property. The way you see it in Los Angeles, like a public land trust or a bunch of people get together to buy something and hold it like in a community trust. In 2 months, we'll see what these two council members come back with the city council, but I'm sure they're gonna try to figure out something, because Laguna Beach without the arts would be something that no one in the city wants to see happen.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, of course, a regular here at GLA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, LA is converting one of its natural gas plants to hydrogen. But combusting hydrogen is controversial. It's not entirely clean. And critics say it could be dangerous. We're going to talk about that tomorrow on Greater LA. We are online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us what's on your mind. What's going on in your neighborhood? Hope you'll grab the podcast, too. All at our website, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. We'd be honored to be in that lineup. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Jay Siebold, Amy Todd, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time and your attention. Have a great night.